Bun! Brav came to a skidding stop in the sandy soil, his jaw dropping in disbelief.
What on Pharos is this?
It's a road. It's the ruins of a caravan the size of a city, he whispered, scanning the thousands of cars baking on the blacktop asphalt.
Well, they weren't all going to the same place, Jeb said with a shrug. I figure if we clear the path, we can get a smooth 30 or 40 mile stretch, Jeb said, motioning to where the road disappeared into the south.
More if this stitching is oblong.
How did humans do this?
This is what you're impressed by? Jeb asked, turning back to the road.
It's just a road connecting one edge of the continent to the other that people could traverse in a matter of hours. Is that such a big deal?
Brav looked like his eyes were going to fall out of his head, so Jeb decided to stop teasing him.
The wagons?
Right, I'll go get them,
Brav said, nodding before turning on his heel and running to where the wagons waited for them.
And I will start looting, Jeb said, picking up a rock and smashing the nearest window.
All in all, the wagons actually went only a little faster on the highway due to the constant need to move cars out of the way. On the other hand, the caravanners were practically crying with joy as they filled all available empty space with human oddities. Glass was especially sought after. Human glass was incredibly clear, and a single glass cup went for a couple silver. They made a stack of carefully detached windshields, also grabbing things like knives, guns, and the odd leather bucket seat to bolt onto their caravan seats. Jeb didn't bother looking for things to sell. He was looking for some wheels, dumping ice-cold river water on his head every few minutes as his shoe tried to melt to the pavement. Jeb actually rested on his peg leg every now and then to allow his foot to cool. The biggest impediment to finding a suitable ride was that many of the cars were empty, weather-worn, and damaged. When the world ended a few months ago, people had been teleported right out of their cars and shoved in tutorials. That meant the cars were left running, moving at 70 miles an hour with no human oversight. Only a handful of smart cars had been able to avoid collisions of any kind. Even the ones that didn't get badly crunched up had been left running until they went empty. If this were in town, that would have been a problem. But they were on the I-5. A fair number of people were on long road trips, and some of them had gas cans in the back. Gas degrades pretty hard over the course of 3 months, but it's still usable. Barely. After a couple hours of searching, he found an oversized Jeep with its right front tire blown out. Other than that, there was some minor damage to the fender where it had cruised to a stop and hit the meridian, but all that was fixable.
It's like me, Jeb thought, glancing down at his own missing leg. Whoever had owned the truck had bought it specifically for off-roading. As the body was lifted, the remaining tires nice and big, and not one but two spares in the back. Off-roading was going to be the name of the game, so Jeb slapped his hand down on the hood and claimed it for himself, nice and loud so the surrounding aliens didn't loot the windshield. After that, he hauled the gas cans over, put a gallon in, and tested the engine. The key was still in the ignition, so it was just a matter of crossing his fingers and hoping the battery was still alive. The machine rumbled to life without complaint or stutter despite running out of gas before sitting there for the better part of 3 months.
Yes! Power!
Jeb cackled, turning it off before starting on changing the tire. Half an hour later, he was tapping the steering wheel and bobbing his head to some kid's EDM, feeling the wind in his hair as he cruised forward at roughly 10 miles per hour. Jeb could just go off-road and ditch his caravan, but that didn't seem like the best idea ever. Not only did Jeb not know where the city was, he was alone. And there was no easier way to get killed or do something stupid and wind up dying than to go it alone. Like into the wild.
Is that some kind of magical pre-recorded music?
Brav asked, driving his wagon alongside Jeb's Jeep.
Pre-recorded, yes. Magical, no.
Jeb blanked out. He didn't actually know how a CD worked.
Probably not magical.
What's playing the music then?
Speakers work by passing a current through copper wire at a rate that makes a vibrating electrical field. The vibration is then picked up and amplified by a set of magnets attached to thin fabric or cloth.
So cloth, copper, and lodestone does all that?
Jeb shrugged. Basically. You'd have to ask an engineer for more specifics. I'm sure there's some electronics in there.
Speaking of engineers, I wonder where all the scientists from NASA wound up.
Jeb was absolutely sure there were some very smart people out there integrating human tech with mist. Mist and mist engines gave the law of conservation of energy the finger. That kind of power would give those nerds wet dreams. If someone went to an oil refinery and found a premium unleaded lens, they could send a ship into space while ignoring fuel weight. Jeb glanced down at the dash of his Jeep, doomed to run out of fuel sometime in the next couple of weeks when all the refined gas in the world dried up or expired.
Hell, I could find a premium unleaded lens. Are there any oil refineries in California?
Jeb needed to keep his eyes open for an abandoned gas station. Jeb tapped the steering wheel some more. Come to think of it, he'd only seen lenses made in nature, hadn't he?
I wonder if man-made things count as natural.
Humans are natural, in the grand scheme of things. What's the difference between a bird's nest and a cheap motel in the eyes of the gods? They were both made by animals to breed in. I wonder if I could visit Silicon Valley and find an AI lens. See if it takes over the world. Let's see. There's all the nature lenses found in Oregon. The beetle lens, the worm lens, the annihilation lens, the flame lenses. The control lens was specifically described as arising because of the behavior of people. Jeb would give even odds that lenses which created advanced sapient-made constructs were either extremely rare or non-existent. Still, it couldn't hurt to visit a few tourist traps on the way south. If I can find a candy factory with a candy lens in it, I won't have to worry about paying smartass ever again.
Gotta visit that gas station and see if he could grab one of those analog maps.
Jeb spotted a dark lump on the ground moments before he ran over it. What's a chunk of pavement doing torn out of the ground? Jeb thought, pulling up short and hopping out.
What is it? Rav asked.
This pavement is out of place, Jeb called back, flipping it over with his foot. The dark asphalt radiated heat from the sun beating down on it. Jeb glanced around, but couldn't see any place it might have come from.
Oh, a sun lens variant, Rav said.
The orange-skinned man knelt down to inspect the chunk of asphalt.
Good eye.
Jeb hadn't noticed it radiating sunlight or the smell of asphalt with his mist senses, because in this weather, everything radiated sunlight and the smell of asphalt.
You found it? It's yours.
The wagoner shrugged and stood.
These common?
Jeb asked, picking up the lens and wincing as it scalded his hand. He wrapped his sleeve around it, finally noticing the sunlight rolling off of it.
Pretty common in deserts. Aristocrats put a higher value on dappled sun lenses or grassy sun lenses, for sun or river sun. Pretty much anything that smells nice or is refreshing. I haven't seen that variant before, but I'll bet you a sun lens that makes the room smell like tar won't sell for a whole lot. You'll get maybe a bulb for it, maybe a handful of silver. Still, not a bad find.
Fair enough, Jeb said, loading the lens into the back seat with the rest of his gear before dumping ice-cold river water on himself again.
God, this lens is a lifesaver.
Jeb thought, eyeing the damp river rock with a thin film of algae slime on it before putting it back in his pocket.
Hey, you guys mind some detours?
Jeb asked, turning around and catching Brav's attention.
There's some places. Zzz!
A squat, shiny brown ball of armor plating about the size of a basketball slammed into Brav's side, tossing him into the ground. The Milos wagoner let out a pained gasp, and Jeb spotted a proboscis about the size of his thumb slipped between the man's ribs, blood welling around the wound.
Zzz!
Jeb's gaze flicked to the side, spotting dozens more chitinous balls flying through the air, flying toward him. Chapter 9. Local Culture, Friendly Wildlife.
Shit!
Jeb stopped, dropped, and rolled, lumps of armor plating flying above him. He rolled under the lifted Jeep, heart hammering in his ears. Jeb whipped his .44 out of his holster. He was too busy to feel the pain of the asphalt scalding his skin or with a sudden jerk had banged his elbow against the metal underside of the car. He was focused on Brav. From his position under the car, Jeb could hear the creatures rebounding off the metal hood, clattering softly onto the ground on either side. And he could see the wagon driver's plight, framed by the underside of the Jeep. The basketball-sized creature attached to his chest was pulsing in a way that couldn't possibly be good for him as the wagoneer tried to pry it off. Jeb aimed as carefully as he could with the shit going on around him and put two bullets into the monster attached to Brov. He was rewarded with the creature flying off in a spray of blood, devastated by the human weapon. Jeb was about to give himself the old mental pat on the back when three more monsters hit the amiable wagoneer, pinning him to the ground and greedily sucking the moisture out of the man's thigh, gut, and neck. Jeb's eyes narrowed. One was survivable, but three? Jeb needed to take care of his own shit before trying to help a dead man. God damn it. Can't stay here forever, Jeb thought, mind racing. He needed to find a place to shelter and think, and these things were numerous. There were at least a dozen on the open asphalt between him and Brov, and who knew how many behind him. Well, no time like the present. He'd already been under the Jeep for a couple seconds, and the unattached creatures were unfolding into evil proboscis armadillos with thick thighs. That's where I draw the line. In a couple more seconds, they were going to sniff him out, and Jeb didn't want to get into a fight under a car. It just sounded like a losing proposition. Jeb propped the gun and reached up, snagging the guts of the Jeep and hauling himself in the direction opposite the creature's origin. If there was a clear spot to stand, it would be just behind the Jeep, where they physically couldn't have landed. Moving light and quick like a teenager was barely enough to stay ahead of the death balls crawling under the Jeep, looking for something to suck on. Jeb came to a stand behind the car in a little wedge of empty space. Everywhere else was filled with unrolling bloodsuckers. Jeb took a quick breath and channeled a strand of mist out, whipping it forward and tugging on the handle of the closest car, a rusty station wagon. The door was locked. Jeb broke into a limping sprint, focusing on the old vehicle's peg locks in the window, pulling them up before yanking on the door handle with everything he had. The last week or so of dedicated mist gathering had raised Jeb's mist capacity substantially. And yanking open the door of a 1992 Buick Roadmaster fell within Jeb's mind-bending supernatural powers. Jeb put his head down and dove, jumping headfirst into the front seat. The gear shift punching him in the liver almost distracted him from closing the door, but he managed to curl his legs out of the way and tuck the door closed with his mind. Clank. The escape only took about 3 seconds, and he'd only stayed ahead of the creatures by a hair. The succadillo bouncing off the car door was pretty good evidence of that. Ugh! Jeb groaned, rubbing his gut and sitting up in the bucket seat and peering out the window, careful not to put his face too close to the glass. No telling if these sons of bitches could pierce glass. Jeb momentarily contemplated the horror cliche of getting trapped inside your car by a monster, your only means of defense tantalizingly out of reach. In this case, Jeb's gun. He rolled his eyes and formed a telekinetic hand. Jeb's ability to move things telekinetically fell into two different categories. He could either imbue something with his mist and move it around directly, but he couldn't bend the object itself. It was held rigid. Good for bulk and immobile weapons. Or he could create exterior forces and use that to act on an object, which allowed for more delicate and complicated maneuvering. In this case, pulling a trigger. Jeb telekinetically reached under the Jeep and grabbed his revolver before he blew away the closest four succadillos harassing his wagon, sending bits and pieces of keratin armor and blood scattering around the sizzling hot pavement. Crap, empty. There were still 30 or so. This could take a few minutes. Jeb glanced into the back of the station wagon as he was rummaging around the Jeep for his box of bullets. The station wagon must have been some teen's hand-me-down car from a parent or an older brother, because the supplies in the back spoke to a teen road trip. Jeb snagged some Cheetos, Red Vines, and a box of root beer, shoving one of the cheesy confections in his mouth while he watched what his telekinetic hand was doing. It was hard to lift a backpack up with one mental hand, place it where he could see it, then rummage around in the pockets for his bullets, but Jeb was managing. He slung the strap on the back of the headrest, then worked his way to the pockets. Smartass waved from the backpack, pointing to Jeb's left. Jeb glanced over and saw a group of Milas and Keegan adventurers carving their way through the sucadillos, using gear that looked specifically designed to penetrate the armor. Short-hafted picks with wicked sharp spikes at the end designed to ignore the armor. They almost looked like those people picking up trash on the sidewalk, minus the reflective jackets, and a fair amount more acrobatics. They moved superhumanly fast, but not so much that Jeb couldn't follow. Presuming no points in missed, they're probably clocking in high teens, low 20s. Jeb reached into the 12-pack and snagged a root beer, wincing when the 130-degree can scalded his skin. He reloaded his gun, setting it on the hood of the station wagon, then settled in to watch the caravan guards do their job. All it took was a creative application of mountain river water flowing around the soda can, and within minutes, Jeb was kicking his feet up on the dash and indulging in a bitingly cold can of some of the last root beer produced in the U.S. Tap, tap. There was one of the Keegan adventurers standing outside the window, his face outside Jeb's field of view. Jeb worked the ancient window, rolling it down with the squeaky winch.
Yeah? Mr. Trapper, the sand fleas are taken care of. It's safe.
Damn, I kinda liked Suckadillo, Jeb muttered, stepping out of the car. He glanced out across the road and saw the caravaneers were taking stock of the situation, figuring out who needed help and who needed burning. Brav, unfortunately, was in the latter category. The hornless Milas lay still along with two others on the side of the road. The caravaneers were practical people, and the deceased were cremated quickly, placed atop a rather small pyre and burned while surrounded by the family, who seemed to take comfort in watching their loved ones reduced to ashes. There were tears, but they were quick to dry. From what Jeb could glean, it was because people dying on a long road trip was par for the course. Everyone threw in together, expecting that some people would die. They were already mentally prepared to say goodbye to the people they traveled with. The thing that Jeb didn't get was why there was a general resentful look in the caravaneer's eyes when they looked at him, as if he was personally responsible for the three deaths somehow. Am I the albatross, perhaps? The caravan guards explained it to him when he inquired about it.
The caravaneers thought you might guarantee a safe journey. They believed you were a rather high-level individual traveling in secrecy. They are simply disappointed that their expectations were unfounded. It is no fault of yours.
The guard spoke while roasting a sand flea leg, waiting for the caravaneers to finish burning their dead. They feel lied to. Damn, people have gotten lynched for less. How do I manage this?
Clear things up?
Jeb glanced at his jeep. He could ditch them here, but that was a last resort. As long as he didn't get lynched, he had food, water, and wheels, so he didn't exactly fear for his life. He sure as hell wouldn't want to be alone through another monster attack, though. If he'd been standing where Brav had been standing? Jeb shook his head. I'll see what I can do. Thanks. Jeb approached Brav's pyre, where his family was sitting around the burning corpse, ignoring the desert heat. They almost seemed as if they were bathing in the thick smoke rising off the body. I'm sorry, Jeb said without preamble.
Sorry for what, human?
The nearest one asked, glancing over at him. Sorry I couldn't have done more to help. I really would have liked to save Brav. He was easy to get along with.
I thought you had missed. You said you had missed. Mist users are supposed to be powerful.
A small Milas protested. I do have mist, but it's not good at dealing with sudden ambushes, Jeb said, lowering his head in the universal sign of contrition. I'll help, but I'm not omnipotent. Please don't blame me for this.
You took us to the road,
one of the younger Milas said, standing. He was maybe 20, with good musculature and an angry look in his eyes, but his horns were underdeveloped, speaking to his youth. The oldest Milas present spoke.
Relax, Los. The road had nothing to do with it. The caravan has profited greatly from the human's knowledge.
He was near 7 feet tall, not including the towering horns, with streaks of gray running through his hair. He put his palm on the youth's shoulder and pushed him back to a sitting position.
It was not this human's obligation to defend us. He is a paying passenger, not a hired guard. And yet he killed 5 sand fleas single-handedly, the first of which being the one attacking Brav. We cannot ask anything more from him. Come to terms with it and redirect your anger.
An olive branch. Older Mine saw the value in not lynching people.
Thank you, Jeb said, nodding.
Thank you for trying to save my son.
Ouch. The caravan master had some serious self-control.
If you have nothing more to say, you should leave. This smoke is poisonous to those who aren't related to Brav.
Jeb blinked.
Of course.
He backed away and left them to their business.
We're born in fire and we die in fire. It's a fitting way to bring a life to an end, am I right?
Amila's guard spoke, shoving a bottle of some murky substance into Jeb's hand.
Mila's babies come out of the pussy on fire? Jeb asked.
Of course. How else would we protect newborns and their mothers from Enoch's Chin? We saw how you took care of those sand fleas. 5 is a bit of a low number, but it's more than enough to earn you a drink.
Jeb glanced down at the drink that looked something like an oil slick.
Oh, what the hell?
He shrugged and took a swallow before his body immediately rejected it. It tasted like some kind of cross between motor oil and whiskey, and it was not meant for human consumption. And Jeb fell to the ground, barely able to keep the bottle straight as he retched out the sip of nightmare fuel.
Guess humans don't like Moros either.
Jeb felt the bottle lifted out of his hand and he turned on his side, trying not to suffocate.
I told you, the Keegan guard said.
Shut up. One day a species will be stitched on that properly appreciates fine drink.
My body is literally incapable of processing that,
Jeb said, groaning.
See?
Bah.
It took Jeb another half an hour or so to wash the taste out of his mouth with a combination of bile and whiskey. During that time, he sat around and chatted with the guards. Most of them were as he expected, somewhere between level 12 and level 20. Their leader was the only one with a class, but he wasn't wealthy enough to be a citizen.
I want to be a baker,
one of them said proudly when Jeb asked him what class he was planning on taking.
What are you doing out here then? Jeb asked. How does getting your ass killed by desert monsters translate to baking? How else am I going to get to level 20 and get the class? It's not like you can gain levels by staying in town and baking all day. Gotta do your part in protecting the people from the monsters of Pharos.
That's dumb, Jeb muttered before doing a double take at the people scowling at him.
Not protecting people from monsters. The fact that you can't get levels for doing the thing you want to do. You're making sure to bake a lot on the side, right?
Of course. Jeb tapped his fingers on the whiskey bottle he'd scavenged out of the back of a dirty SUV.
So, why baker?
You can be a baker without a class in a small town, but I want to open up a pastry shop in a city. A class is just the kind of edge I would need to make it big.
Oh, so how many of the rest of you are here on your college thesis?
More than half of the guards' hands went up. The younger, more starry-eyed guards. Now that Jeb was alerted to it, he could easily tell the difference between the people who had chosen risking their lives as a career and the ones who were doing it to get their class. Going adventuring was almost exactly like going to college, with the exception of possible death. All Jeb had to do was look for the ones who seemed like they belonged in frat houses or sororities.
What about you?
Jeb asked, glancing at the oldest guard, a wrinkled Keegan.
Caravan guard, level 24. My class, and I quote, has a passive effect that negates the adverse effects of constant travel on my mind, body, and equipment.
So the road feels like a relaxing cruise?
Basically, the Keegan shrugged. When I set out, I was just like them. I wanted the levels to take over my dad's smithy, but after I got a taste of the road, I guess I got wanderlust. Don't worry about my dad, Smithy. I got 7 brothers. How about you? You ever get a class?
All eyes turned to Jeb. Oh, sure. It's Mystic Trapsmith, Jeb said with a shrug. Going through the tutorial, I wasn't really concerned about picking what I wanted to do for a living, just living.
You know what I mean?
Sucks, one of the girls said.
What's it do?
Amila's guard asked, perking up. Mystic Trousmith has something called Mystic Triggers, Jeb said. For example, if I wanted to make a trap that would squeeze the trigger of this gun, all I would have to do would be to make a missed trigger and specify an event and a response. When the event happens, the response is that my mist squeezes this trigger, Jeb said, pointing at his pistol.
Your class lets you pull triggers on guns?
No, you could have it do pretty much anything you could normally do with mist, but it has to be predetermined. The trigger can't think.
What kinds of events?
A Keegan girl asked, cocking her head. Jeb sighed.
This is going to be a long night.
He was about an hour into explaining the concept of a chain of if-then logic when the older guard shot to his feet, staring off in the distance.
Ginja Bragosh!
The real thing Keegan growled an expletive the system was too polite to translate.
Sand pirates! They've seen the funeral smoke. I told those fat, fiery bastards this might happen. Everyone, unless you've got rich parents or a boatload of money, I suggest hiding.
There was a general cry of dismay among the college kids as they leapt to their feet, scrambling this way and that while their leader unsheathed his sword.
Way to inspire confidence.
Hard hammering, Jeb came to his feet and peered out into the distance. He could make out a tiny puff of sand in the distance, kicked up by something that was rapidly approaching.
How much time do we have? Jeb asked. 15 minutes, perhaps, the Keegan said. Then they will kill all the male guards, sell or ransom the female guards, steal a large portion of the cargo, and let the caravaneers go unharmed.
Unharmed? Jeb asked, as that last phrase landed in his mind.
Why fleece a breek only once? Ah.
The Keegan glanced over at Jeb's jeep.
Your wagon moves fast enough to outrun them, if you wish. I've seen you take it off the road.
Jeb glanced at his jeep. We'll call that Plan B. In the meantime, I don't want to leave you in the lurch. I've got an idea of how to get rid of them, and it shouldn't take longer than a couple of minutes.
That would be appreciated, Mr. Trapper.
Jeb broke into a sprint, aiming for his car. He jumped over the door, landing in the open top, and began searching through the back seat for his backpack, where Smartass had turned the foot space into a swimming pool.
It's so hot out here,
she groaned, splashing her feet in the water, likely summoned from Jeb's smooth river rock.
I had to plug up a few holes with the clay lens, but I made the perfect place to cool off. Come on, dip your toes.
God damn it, Smartass. There's rustables in here, and those holes are ventilation, Jeb said, yanking the backpack out of the water and rummaging through until he came out with the fireball wands, still looking like a German pistol from the 40s.
You try to do something nice for people,
Smartass said, shaking her head as Jeb jumped back out, peg leg clacking on the ground as he landed. He'd hidden the mist engine under the frame of the car with a strong Heideki magnet, as Jeb was fairly sure it was contraband. The glass tube was gritty and wet. I am so kicking her ass when this is over, Jeb thought, watching the dust clouds grow larger as he carefully, carefully cleaned and dried the mist engine. Jeb was able to see the distant figures well enough to make out individual bodies by the time he finished cleaning the engine. They were mostly beefy Milas, ranging from orange to an almost reddish color. The one in the lead had some pretty epic horns visible even from this distance. They were riding a large flat ship that skimmed across the surface of the rocky desert, navigating the rock seemingly without issue. Jeb wasn't sure if it was decorative or an engine of some sort, but he spotted jets of flame shooting out either side of the boat, perhaps acting as propellant.
Man, I hope this works,
Jeb thought, blowing imaginary dust out of the wand. He opened the panel and clicked the engine into place, making absolutely sure the fiber optics made contact and that there was no grip between them and the engine. Once Jeb was done, he rolled a scrap of cloth and shoved it in his ear, covering the other with his palm.
You might want to cover your ears, Jeb shouted, holding the wand above his head. What's that supposed to? Boom!
A gigantic flower of bright flaming explosion appeared above them, the impact rattling their bones and setting off a few of the honking car alarms. Inspired, Jeb adjusted the range and pulled the trigger again,
exploding the air above a dense patch of cars. Any car that still had battery left immediately began crying bloody murder, assuming someone was trying to break into it.
Gods!
The League guard shouted, slapping his palms over his ears. Now that everyone was sufficiently spooked, Jeb jumped into the Jeep and cranked the engine, which turned over with a victorious roar. Oh, thank God Smartass didn't ruin everything.
What's that awful racket?
Smartass demanded, hauling herself out of the water by the cup holder. Jeb glanced over his shoulder.
Sorry.
Sorry for what?
Jeb gunned it. The ferry and all the water surrounding her was violently sloshed into the back as Jeb charged the pirates, finally able to open the engine now that he was off-road. Kinda like a metaphor for my life. Jeb stuck the wand out the open top and began pulling the trigger non-stop, creating a string of explosions above him, marching straight toward the approaching pirates at roughly 60 miles an hour.
Boom, 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 boom.
Jeb laid on the horn with his thumb as he approached, filling the space in between the explosions with the Jeep's piercing wail.
Boom,
e,
boom,
e,
boom,
e,
boom,
e,
boom.
Craig, the unswerving, warrior level 32.
Payday, gentlemen,
Craig said, lowering the spyglass from his eye.
We've got a caravan loaded down with artifacts from the stitching, and a new place to pick over. They've got so much loot, we may not have space for prisoners.
We've always got space for the right prisoners, Captain,
one of the sleazier crewmen said, eliciting a roar of approval.
Morale is always a factor,
Craig thought, eyeing the dumb bastard.
Aye, that we do,
Craig said with a smirk. The cheering redoubled as they turned the jets on. The jets were mist engines stolen from the military strapped to oil lenses. The resulting spray then atomized as it shot through a spinning grate. The resulting black mist was lit on fire and they were off, cruising over the bushy surface of the alien desert fast enough to drive the wind through their hair, tugging at their loose clothes. Boulders and other large impediments got shoved under the sand by the Faradan stone coating the bottom of the boat. Craig was hoping they had a gold lens the size of his thumb. With the right application of a mist engine, they could live like kings.
Well, not all of us,
he thought, eyeing the rest of his crew. If he found a gold lens of sufficient size, they would start dropping like flies. Less shares to split. They would die and he would become Mr. Craig, legitimate businessman. Craig was contemplating murder when there was a flash of light above the caravan, followed by a rumble they heard above the sounds of the jets.
What in the royal was that?
Craig thought. If he didn't know any better, Craig would have guessed it was a light anti-infantry weapon straight from the Empire's military. Those were only wielded by powerful aristocrats who showed up simply to flick their wrist and cause mass destruction amongst the rank and file. He should know because he spent nearly a decade working for the bastards. A moment later, there was another flaming explosion above the caravan, followed by another rumble elsewhere above the caravan. A moment before he thought he heard something.
Hold! Kill the jets!
The pirate manning the steering wheel pulled the oily lever with a clunk, stalling out the ship as the stream of burning oil stopped. The boat slid to a gentle stop, their ears adjusting to the sudden silence.
What is it, Captain?
Shh! Craig cocked his head, pointing his good ear toward the caravan. The cacophony of noise sounded like eerie wailing from this distance, making the thick hairs on the back of his neck stand up.
What in the royal is going on over there?
Craig muttered, bringing up his spyglass. The eyes of the strange human wagons on the road were blinking open and closed like living things while giving off terrifying wails, and one of them was moving. The boxy thing pulled off the road and turned to face them before it began moving toward them. It began moving toward them fast. Another flash and rumble sounded as the box wagon charged toward them, at speeds that outpaced their expensive Faradan-clad boats.
I don't like the look of that,
one of the men, Smurs, said, shaking his head.
Who?
Boom.
E
boom.
E
boom.
E
boom.
E
Boom. The rumbles got louder as the strange contraption flew toward them, creating its own cloud of dust as it flew over the rough terrain, gouts of flame bursting in the air above it as it charged. Craig had a decision to make. He had to decide right here and now whether the value they would get out of the caravan was worth the damage to his boat and crew.
Turn the ship around. We'll go after easier prey.
Jeb Trapper. And that, Jeb said as he came to a lurching halt in front of the caravan, is how you perform a threat display. Jeb craned his neck to study the retreating cloud of dust.
Much appreciated,
Brav's dad said, nodding. We should get the fuck out of here before they realize it.
Agreed.
Chapter 10. Road Trip. Jeb loomed over a map of the West Coast, practically butting heads with Smartass as they both surveyed the details. Okay, here's the POIs, Jeb said, circling the three oil refineries in California, the candy factories between here and L.A., and Silicon Valley. Jeb found his eye sliding to the east where Las Vegas stood, only 200 miles away from L.A.
What's in Las Vegas?
Smartass asked, following his gaze.
Sex clubs. Lots and lots of sex clubs. They'd be my number two choice for places that can spawn good vibes lenses, right after hippie music festivals and right before SCA meetups. Except these are fixed locations.
You realize these places are actually twice as far away from each other as they normally would be because of the stitching, right?
Jeb located himself on the I-5, then used a Blue's Clues ruler he'd taken from the back of a car to measure the distance. 800 miles to L.A., where Somnath would have dropped into existence. Double that number for Stitched in Wilderness, and you got about 1,600 miles as the crow flies. Of course, it would be a lot more because Jeb wasn't flying, and he didn't trust himself to learn how to land a plane that had been left in disrepair for 3 months on the first try. Jeb used the cartoon dog ruler to estimate the total distance of the trip if he hit each of his POIs. 2,700 miles, give or take. Let's see. If we drive Mr. Jeep at about 40 miles an hour off-road, 10 hours a day, just under a week to check all the places I want to check. I could check all my POIs and be to Somnath 2 weeks ahead of these chumps. Jeb tapped the map with his pen a couple times. He would be a lot safer in a caravan, but he would also miss out on a potential boatload of sweet loot and lost time value. As Jeb was weighing the pros and cons, Brav's dad approached Jeb's lonely corner of the caravan, glancing down at Jeb's map.
Are you planning on heading east?
The caravan leader asked, tapping the map where Jeb had circled Vegas.
Thinking about it,
Jeb said, nodding.
Better be absolutely sure that's what you want to do, because the Royal is roaming those parts right now. It's a bit north of here, last I heard, but you can never be 100% sure.
Jeb frowned. I've heard people swear using Royal. I just assumed it was the local equivalent of hell. It's a real thing?
Young man, I've spent 15 years chasing that storm as a youth. It's as real as it gets, and twice as unpredictable.
So what is it? Jeb asked, leaning against the jeep.
It's a living storm that's plagued Pharos since the first stitching. Some people say it's a tiny mistake in the tremendous magics that stitched one world to another.
What's it look like? Jeb asked.
It's invisible, sort of,
the Milas said, holding his hands apart.
It bends and reflects light.
Like the Predator, Jeb said, nodding.
Sure,
the Milas said with a shrug.
If you see the most awe-inspiring rainbow of colors on the horizon, you better steer clear. If you hear something that sounds like a voice, you need to get the fuck out of there.
The Milas clapped him on the shoulder.
Good luck out there, Jeb, whatever you decide to do.
A moment later, the aged caravaneer headed off. Well, that's creepy, Jeb thought, his gaze returning to Vegas on the map. Choosing discretion as the better part of valor, Jeb crossed off Sin City. Whatever lenses they had probably weren't worth risking his life for. What about my gas? Do I even have enough to travel all the way to L.A.? Assuming a paltry 15 miles to the gallon, because Jeb had no idea what Mr. Jeep's actual numbers were, the gas was old, and they were off-roading, Jeb needed 180 gallons. Jeb glanced into the back of his car, where the two 15-gallon plastic jugs full of unleaded rested. Plus, the car's tank is full. That only accounts for about a third of the trip. Thankfully, there was a lot of road between here and there. Jeb was fairly sure he could scrounge up the fuel as he went, as long as he didn't try to cut a straight swath through the wilderness and stuck close to the I-5. Jeb adjusted his trip plan to stay as close to the roads as possible. How do you feel about visiting the candy factory first? Jeb asked.
It's fine, I guess.
Smartass said with a shrug. Fine? I thought you'd be losing your damn mind.
I do love candy, but the thing that makes your candy really taste good is the effort you put into acquiring it, she said. If you no longer need to spend any effort, I won't get as much impact out of it.
Jeb put down his ruler. Want to renegotiate?
I don't know. After you screwed me out of the 10 bulbs in the last deal.
Hey, we weren't actually in agreement with Granora when I claimed those bounties, so tough luck. Jeb took a breath. How about we renegotiate the monthly candy payment to a 2% share of any impact gained?
That sounds great,
Smartass said, leaping up in the air and zipping around in excitement for a moment. With a few strings attached.
Aw.
General assistance and tutoring clause, Jeb said. Small tasks, basic information, teaching. Stuff that doesn't cost you inordinate impact or put you in danger. Smartass puffed her cheeks up and scowled at him. Come on, I know 2% is way higher than a pound of candy, especially if I find a sugar lens. Smartass scowled even more, her face wrinkling up comically. You're gonna have to make a decision soon because when I find that sugar lens, getting you your monthly payment will become effortless. Jeb smiled, letting that last word hang in front of her.
Yeah, fine. 2% of your impact per month for a standard familiar contract,
Smartass said with a huff. Hell no, Jeb said, shaking a finger at her. 2% of impact gained, not 2% of my total per month, you sneaky fay. Smartass gave an irritated grunt.
I don't know, Jeb. This is a long-term investment here. You can't gain a lot of impact right now. But if you regain your strength, your growth rate might make it worth my time. How do I know you'll be able to go the distance? You might get killed by sand fleas tomorrow. I want 5%.
Please. I beat the impossible tutorial. You know I'm good for it. 2.5%.
Deal.
Smartass cackled.
I got you to raise your offer by a full 25%, you gullible fool. 2.5% is worth hundreds of times more than a pound of candy.
Now to test it. Here, help me out and cross off the candy factories, Jeb said, holding out the pen.
Oh, sure,
the fairy said, grabbing the pen and crossing out the candy factory locations, easily shaving a couple 100 miles off the trip. The oil refinery should be first. Even if they don't have a gasoline lens, they should at least have 55-gallon drums of gas I can load into the back of the car. I'm getting thirsty. Snag me one of those root beers, Jeb said, taking the pen back.
Of course.
Smartass fluttered away toward the back of the Jeep. And run some river water over it until it's nice and cold, Jeb called after her.
Sure. Hey, wait a minute.
Smartass glared at him the entire time she rummaged through the supplies for the soda and Riverstone. Jeb turned his attention to the map, plotting out the best route. A few minutes later, a can of soda was thrust under his nose, condensation beading down the aluminum sides.
Here.
Smartass growled at him, holding it out with both hands, her cheeks twitching madly. Jeb glanced down at the soda. Set it down over there. He pointed to the edge of the hood of the car they were using as a table.
Okay.
Open it. Smartass's eyes went wide even as her fingers went for the tab.
You know, I really don't think that's necessary. You can just... Whoosh!
Smartass gasped as ice-cold soda sprayed all over her front. Thankfully, the fairy was wearing a plastic Snickers wrapper tunic, which was mostly waterproof. She stood there in shock, eyes wide and shivering, dripping root beer from head to toe. Smartass, I'm going to make you a promise right here, Jeb said, picking up the can and taking a sip.
I promise from this point on, I will not intentionally give abusive commands. This promise will last until our arrangement with each other has run its course, or such a time as you try to sabotage or monkey paw me. If something I'm asking you to do is abusive, simply let me know. With words. Does that sound good? Smartass nodded, staring into space. Excellent. Root beer?
I don't like root beer anymore,
Smartass whispered. All right then, Jeb said, marking the new route down. Jeb was wavering on the decision to go solo for a while, and the deciding factor was the time value. If he could get to Somnath 2 weeks earlier, then he could catch the bad guys 2 weeks earlier, and that meant one or two not-dead children. Plus, with Smartass now obligated to follow orders and invest in his survival, he wasn't completely alone, and that made a big difference in his survivability out there. Jeb heaved a breath, looking down at the map one last time before rolling it up and shoving it in the back of the Jeep. I'll go say goodbye. The next week was a long string of nervous tension punctuated with butt-clenching moments here and there, when they had to speed away from desert monsters and pirates. Smartass's new job was scout and lookout. She muttered a bit about the menial jobs, but it wasn't abusive and they both knew it. She would scout out a place and see if anything was living there, and Jeb would loot it. While Jeb was looting, the fairy would then watch outside for any signs of monsters or bandits, informing him as soon as she saw something. 3 times this stopped Jeb from walking out the door loaded up with loot while a horde of monsters wandered by. Once, she found a school bus-sized lizard Jeb had no desire to tangle with sleeping inside, and they avoided the location entirely. Jeb shamelessly appropriated gold bars and coins from safety deposit boxes in banks across the West Coast, tossing them in the small trailer he'd snagged for loot. Rummaging through the safety deposit boxes didn't just yield gold bars and expensive jewelry. Jeb found all sorts of things that people found valuable, from letters from grandma, baby teeth, and even a snarl of gunk and hair that looked like it had been thrown up by an owl. He even found some old blackmail material of various kinds. Photos taken by PIs, a disc with Night with Tim printed on the front, old Nazi paraphernalia. Some truly weird stuff that Jeb shoved back in the boxes without hesitation. One would hope the tutorial would clean that kind of person off the face of the earth, but things usually didn't work out that way. A few things Jeb didn't have the heart to steal. There was a gold necklace from a dead grandmother along with a heartwarming note that Jeb put back in the box and left for someone else. Anything that looked like it belonged on a wrapper was fair game, though. As it turned out, gasoline lenses did exist. Jeb found one in the second refinery he visited. The place was torn in half by the stitching, and one of the massive steel vats they used to refine oil was cut in half. Its contents long since spilled out into the dead brush and dried up until only a sticky tar remained. The bottom of the apartment complex-sized tank was a white-painted chunk of steel covered in thick sludge, its paint and markings suspiciously like those of the holding tanks. Jeb funneled a drop of mist through the fist-sized lens and spent the rest of the day smelling like gasoline, much to Smartass's amusement. After that, he made sure to use a net and telekinesis to probe around the inside of all the sludge-filled tanks, scoring several more types of oil lenses, namely kerosene, jet fuel, diesel, lubricant, and tar. Thankfully, he managed to gather these without blowing himself up. I bet Elon Musk would pay a mint for one of these, Jeb said when he found the jet fuel lens. That was the kind of shit that could launch a colony to another planet. Sadly, Jeb lacked the technical skills to make that happen, so he would probably wind up using the priceless treasure to fuel an oil lamp or something. Does Elon Musk still exist? Does Mars still exist? If Earth got torn up and moved somewhere else, it stood to reason that Mars got left behind. Human refugees became more common the closer Jeb got to civilization, and Jeb found himself having to wave his gun around a lot more than he was comfortable with to drive people off trying to raid his trailer. He even wound up running away from some Mad Max types, spiky Mohawks and AK-47s and all. Thankfully, any chase was made easier by pulling the keys out of the opposition's ignition with telekinesis. Smartass flipped their safeties on, too, which was nice of her. Jeb visited a prison off the highway and found a hopelessness lens on the grounds, as well as several families of squatters using it as a fortress a la The Walking Dead. Jeb was able to barter his way in with live hairs from the Hairlands and refilling their water tank. Predictably, they tried to lock him up and force him to use his mist powers to provide food and drinking water indefinitely, but Jeb politely waited until night, unlocked the cell, and left while they were asleep. They took a few pot shots at him while he was driving away, but none of them hit anything important. Cruising through the dusty ruins of Sacramento, Jeb searched strip clubs, banks, cash for gold places, and so on. He found a euphoria, addictive lens that looked like a lumpy white pill about the size of a pinky, a glitter lens that looked like a miniature disco ball, and several different dancing lenses, a couple of them pretty exotic. Honestly, none of them were particularly useful in and of themselves, but unless Jeb missed his guess, they were probably incredibly valuable to the upper crust of the Empire, who would likely pay through the nose to have a good time. Jeb stored the party lenses away in a small locking case, lest he be tempted to misuse them, and shoved them in the very back of his trailer. Jeb got into the habit of parking his Jeep at the top of the highest point he could find at night, taking turns with Smartass keeping an eye out for things trying to sneak up on them. One particular night, Jeb was leaning back in the driver's seat, feet thrown up on the dash as the last light disappeared toward the west. They had just finished setting up the blind that camouflaged the Jeep and were settling down to sleep for the night. Jeb folded his hands behind his head and closed his eyes, body relaxing as the glare from the sun gradually faded from his left. He was parked on top of a particularly tall butte that had been stitched in from Pharos, making a natural semi-mountain in the middle of the flat Californian terrain. Jeb groaned awake what felt like a short time later as the glare of sunlight began peeking in through his right-hand side, making his eyelids glow flickering red from the inside. Flickering? The blind could make the morning sun flicker if it were windy, blowing around their camouflage, but Jeb didn't hear any wind. Something's wrong. Jeb peeked open one eye, not wanting to make any sudden movements. There was a possibility whatever beast was sniffing around his car hadn't found him for sure yet. Best not to startle anything with big ugly claws. Jeb's other eye opened, and he frowned at the shifting rainbow on the horizon. It looked something like the Northern Lights, but much brighter, more energetic, and... A shock ran through Jeb's body, and he lunged up to get a better look.
Ah!
Smartass was flung out of her makeshift nest in his hair, landing prone on the dash.
What is it?
Smartass asked, rubbing her eyes, obviously having been asleep during her watch. Off in the distance, Jeb could see multiple suns rising, their light split into dozens of different facets. Jeb frowned as he watched one of the suns wink out, while another appeared off to the left, and another reversed its course, sinking back below the jagged, stitched mountain horizon. Jeb narrowed his eyes and peered at the mountains. The snow-capped heights dried in seconds, bursting into green for a moment before turning a desolated brown, followed by pale bluish-white as the flickering rainbow sunlight crested above the mountain. Jeb watched in horrified fascination as the strange phenomena climbed onto the spine of the mountain, causing odd fluctuations in the terrain as it went. Jeb watched as the rapid fluctuations in terrain flowed down the mountainside toward him like a rainstorm sweeping down a slope. Jeb turned the key and the engine rumbled to life. Jeb could feel a trembling sensation that seemed to emanate from the scintillating light show creeping over the mountain, washing over him in barely perceived waves. It crawled across the ground through the floor of his Jeep, scaled his legs, straight up his spine before worming its way behind his eyes. The odd whooshing noises from the top of the mountain began to sound less like a wind instrument and more like a voice, humming a tune that Jeb couldn't quite recognize. He definitely heard it somewhere, though. He cocked his head, trying to figure out the melody. Ow! Jeb's head jerked as he snapped out of the odd trance. Smartass was hunched over, pinching the back of his hand with everything she had.
I think we should be going now, Jeb said, craning his neck to keep an eye on the storm as they turned away.
It wasn't moving very fast, maybe 15 miles an hour, but Jeb didn't want to be anywhere near whatever the hell that was. He drove the Jeep down the opposite side of the butte, the Jeep threatening to roll over several times as they made their way down the dusty hill. Jeb spared a second between boulders to glance over at Smartass, who was glancing out the back of the truck at the flickering rainbows behind them.
I thought the agreement was you keep watch at night and I let you sit on the air conditioner during the day, Jeb accused, his hands jerking as the right tire caught an oversized rock.
Jeb compensated quick before they began tumbling down the hillside.
But it's so boring,
Smartass protested. It was an informal arrangement because I thought you could handle the responsibility. I guess I was wrong. You've lost your air conditioner privileges, Jeb said, hitting the gas as they neared the bottom of the butte, turning south and aiming for the desolate highway.
No!
After the close encounter with Arroyal, Jeb continued to scavenge his way down the west coast until he came across Somnath in all its glory. LA and Somnath were both so big that the stitching tore them apart, mixing them back together in a confusing jumble of architecture. Yold Castle stood right next to skyscrapers, and the city wall had a huge 10-mile-long rent in the side where the American city and its paved roads spilled out into the desert. They were currently in the process of patching those pale blue walls up, but in the meantime, anyone could just drive in if they chose. On his way in, Jeb came across more and more people fleeing the city, cheeks sunken and hollow from lack of food. Men, women, and children were leaving the city in what appeared to be a mass exodus, carrying little but the clothes on their back, wandering out into the desert to die. They gave him strange, hungry looks when they saw the color in his cheeks, and Jeb didn't stay long enough to find out what it meant. He faced forward and hit the gas. Deeper into the city, he found the public order somewhat retained as he came across the people who could afford to eat. There was a port with a massive fleet of fishing boats just outside the torn coast, navigating the complicated stitchwork that had been created when the two uneven coastlines merged. Jeb's opportunity to buy a mansion came easier than he thought it would. As it turned out, the aristocrats of Somnath had sort of hermit-crabbed into the more impressive skyscrapers, bringing their servants with them. This made it almost downright cheap to buy the recently abandoned mansions and castles. Of course, cheap meant cheap for a mansion, and Jeb still had to pay about 10 pounds of gold bullion for a semi-abandoned property, with peeling paint and weeds choking the front lawn. It was big, though. 3 stories, with 40 rooms on each floor, kitchen, bathrooms, basic plumbing. With a little TLC, Jeb could see it housing several hundred people. Now I just need to staff it, Jeb thought, scanning the massive building. Cole Rijan, level 57 courier. Cole Rijan walked through the doors of Garland Grenor's office, head on a swivel, taking in every little detail. His heart beat measured but heavy. He knew that he'd made enemies along the path of his career, and there was every chance this Grenor fellow had arranged a trap. There was a bodyguard in the corner, but the way that gravity was pulling on his skin and hair, his body couldn't be any higher than 20. The dim look in his eye didn't suggest much nerve either, and the Milas certainly wasn't a mystic. They didn't take low-paying bodyguard jobs. Cole dismissed the Milas as a threat and reoriented on the slimy businessman in front of him. Garland Grenor was wearing typical loose Keegan clothing, albeit made of rich Xanta silk and woven gold. Tiaki. Cole was wearing similar loose clothing. Although his was far more drab, it was also concealing body armor and several hidden weapons.
Cole Rijan,
Garland said, rising in his chair and offering Cole his hand.
You come highly recommended, I must say.
Cole stared at the hand until the buffoon put it away.
Highly recommended by who?
Come now, I was instructed not to tell anyone that. You're someone? As far as I'm concerned, it came to me in a dream. I don't even remember.
Good, at least the rich man had a modicum of discretion. Cole glanced over his shoulder at the bodyguard.
Your bodyguard might be more comfortable outside in the hall for the next few minutes.
Indeed, it's rather a hot day.
Grenor nodded to the muscle, who shrugged and left, leaving the two of them alone. Cole briefly lamented not having a contract for the sleaze in front of him. If he had, he'd already be done with his job, and he'd probably enjoy it.
You're going to write a letter, he said. Address it to the target. Pay me my fee, and I will deliver it.
Oh? Is that it? I thought you were going to...
Obviously, I'm going to kill him.
Cole interrupted, his head pounding from the sheer stupid.
Is there anything in particular I should write?
No, I'm going to kill him,
If you want me to deliver the letter first, that'll cost extra.
Well then, what would that cost?
Grinar asked as he dipped his pen and wrote a big fuck you diagonally across the page in flowery letters.
200. Up front.
Done.
Garland folded the letter and slipped it in an envelope.
As for his address, just his name, or...
Name and location, to the best of your knowledge.
Jebediah Trapper,
Grinar muttered as he wrote.
Somnath.
There you go, he said, sliding the letter across the polished wood.
My fee.
How do I know you'll follow through? I'm not so naive as to part with my money before a service has been rendered. I'll give you money when I see that bastard's head bleeding on my desk.
Cole gave a flat stare.
My reputation is sterling. Yours leaves much to be desired. You will pay me in advance. I could just as easily kill you right now and walk away with the money in your desk. Do not test me.
Yes.
Grinar pulled out a drawer and swiftly placed 5 leather cases on the table, each carrying 40 bulbs. Cole picked them up and slung their straps over his shoulder, hid the cases under his flowing clothes, then picked up the letter. He wasn't actually going to deliver them, no matter what he told his clients. Who was going to contradict him? The target? Cole had become fairly adept at lying. Describing the anger, fear, and anguish as his target read the final message from his employer. Actually giving them the letter was too much of a security risk, but that service was entirely for the client's gratification anyway, so a lie worked just as well. The moment the letter was in his hand, Cole's second-class ability, unerring delivery, kicked in, and he felt an immaterial tug guiding him towards his target, towards the south.
Thank you for your patronage. Expect word from me in about 3 grand.
Cole pocketed the letter and turned away, still feeling the gradual tug toward the recipient of the letter.
Become a carrier, son. There's a lot of job opportunities out there for people who can deliver.
How right he was. In the history of the world, how many couriers had reached level 50? Not too many. Which is why his ability to find anyone, anywhere, was so highly valued. Cole took the occasional side job finding lost children or relatives, but hunting down traitors and assassinating them paid much, much better.
3 grand? It only takes 4 weeks to get there. I swear, if this is some kind of scam...
Cole glanced over his shoulder and the windbag deflated, unwilling to complain to Cole's face. Cole rolled his eyes and turned away again, leaving the office. Scammers see scams everywhere they look. It was the nature of the beast.
Well, that's settled. Now the...
Cole heard Grinar say before he faded out of earshot. Cole left the way he'd come, stepping out onto the street and taking a moment to breathe in the fresh mountain air. It wouldn't be long before he had to deal with the stench of Somnath. He turned to the south, allowing the tugging sensation from his ability to guide his feet. He had a letter to deliver. Chapter 11. Buying Company.
This must be the place,
Jeb said, glancing up at the sign. Otto's slave house hung over the door, according to Smartass, but it wasn't sleazy and written on a plank of wood. It was carved into marble and gold, hung above the entrance of the fancy-looking building by thin strands of some kind of unnaturally strong silk. The only thing that gave the place away as a den of scum and villainy was the stench of hopelessness and the subtle change in the flavor of local mist and spirits. They were darker, somehow.
Yeah, I'm not too sure about this place,
Smartass said, hiding in his collar as he walked into the main lobby. It was like an entrance to an opera house, all rag carpets and snooty staffers. The entire place was lit with a warm glow which did little to offset the unease that Jeb felt as he approached the main desk. The Keegan watched him from behind the desk, brow raised. No matter what happened now, the most important thing was to avoid getting added to the merchandise.
I'm sorry, sir, but we do not serve human.
Jeb slung 3 cases of bulbs, 120 of them in total, onto the desk with a satisfying thunk. Over 7 pounds of gold.
How about we skip all that shit and get to the part where you sell me some people?
Jeb asked, giving the guy the do-not-fuck-with-me look he'd developed in his time in the army. A well-timed stare-down was often better than minutes of useless explanations and haggling. It allowed the other guy to fill in their own blanks.
You must be the human who bought the Linhorn Manor,
Akigan said, approaching from the side.
Please forgive my employee's impudence. Your money is good here.
Of course it is, Jeb thought, slinging the cases back over his shoulder. The new Keegan motioned to the side with delicate fingers. Jeb tried to figure out if it was male or female, then decided he didn't care, following alongside the slave trader.
My name is Colas. I assume you're here to look for staffers for your new home? We have some young women who would be perfect for a virile man such as yourself. There hasn't been much time to train them, obviously, but there have been so many humans selling themselves and each other for a meal that it's a bit of a buyer's market out there. As such, we can simply use the power of numbers to search for people that most closely match your tastes. Are you looking for a project, perhaps? A girl that will take some time and effort, but be rewarding to tame? Or perhaps you prefer a more docile, bookish type. Or a matronly housewife to care for your body and, soothe your spirits?
Are you working me right now? Jeb asked, frowning. Never mind, of course you are. I don't think anybody's ever called me virile before. Feels weird. Just arrange for me to view everyone you've got, Jeb said. I'll do the rest myself.
As you wish.
Collis stopped him in the hall for a moment and sent word to gather everyone in the courtyard. They chatted for a couple of minutes, and Jeb made sure not to let anything personal slip, especially not the reason he was here. Sure, people to help run his mansion were helpful, but they weren't the actual reason he was here. And since he couldn't directly lie about that, the conversation kind of went in circles. The worker gave Collis a nod, and the Keegan led Jeb out into the main courtyard in the center of the complex. There were a staggering amount of slaves there. Jeb had no idea where they even kept all of them. The courtyard was maybe half the size of a football field, and it was standing room only. Every race, age, and gender stared back at him, a full representative sample of America with collars around their necks, staring back at him with apprehension. Jeb couldn't help but notice there were some very pretty young women. God damn it. Jeb mentally kicked himself for even entertaining the notion. Lizard brain being stupid. Time for big, wrinkly human forebrain to step in and take care of this.
Everybody under the age of 30, out, Jeb said, motioning with his thumb. I don't want to deal with your hormonal bullshit.
Or give my darker side control over someone I find attractive. Men and women over the age of 30 were far less likely to try and stage a coup out of some misguided need for rebellion against the man. In this case, Jeb was going to be the man. Collis nodded and people began to filter out of the crowd, led away by the friendly neighborhood slave handlers. Jeb saw women under the age of 18 and children that must have been only 10 or 12 escorted out. He wanted to save each and every one of them, but there were dozens, hundreds of children. He couldn't stomach saving one and not the rest, and besides, they were more of a liability than anything else. So Jeb left them to their fate. That one condition substantially reduced the volume and physical attractiveness of the people he was presented with. Instead of 10,000 people, he was offered only a couple thousand. What's the going price on these people? Jeb asked.
10 bulbs for unskilled labor, 20 bulbs for young unskilled labor. Although you seem to have already cut off that option. 25 bulbs for a skilled craftsman and 40 bulbs for a high expert or low classer. High classer prices are determined individually, and I'm afraid we don't have any in stock today.
That's it? Would a schoolmarm count as skilled or unskilled?
Unskilled.
Well, looks like I've got more spending money than I thought. Raise your hand if you were a teacher in a high school. About 100 hands went up. Over a decade of experience. A few hands went down.
If I may ask, why school teachers of the high schooling? Are they actually high experts?
Not exactly, Jeb said. High school isn't actually high schooling. That would be college. High school was the proving ground where teachers deal with hundreds of adolescent humans going through the heights of puberty. The absolutely most disobedient, rash, stupid, malicious stage any human goes through. Any high school teacher with a decade or more of experience managing teens is tough. I'm looking for a pair to put that experience to work managing my property and the people living there. Jeb failed to mention the children that would be living there, but the rest of it was the truth.
Interesting logic.
You taught AP classes. More hands went down. This is a difficult one to answer, but just go with your gut, I guess. The kids respected you. A lot more hands went down. In the end, Jeb narrowed it down to an English teacher and a history teacher, both of whom had cultivated contradicting airs of friendliness, sarcasm, and no-nonsense attitudes, which was exactly what Jeb was looking for. People who could both relate to children and handle them were rare. The English teacher was a balding man with white hair, one Mr. Everett. He had a glint of humor in his eye as Jeb motioned him to the front, despite the situation. Mr. Everett, how do you feel about being a butler? Jeb said, putting his hand out. Good a job as any, kid, the older man said, shaking his hand. Mrs. Lang, the history teacher, was a brunette with short cropped hair and a somewhat bony body in her mid-50s. Her gaze scanned the situation and seemed to take in everything and add it up behind her eyes. Both of them were sharp. Good. Mrs. Lang, how do you feel about being a butler?
Honestly, better than I thought my fate would be, given the circumstances. Old slaves in many cultures were simply left out to die.
That's not my scene. Jeb opened one of his cases and slipped out two tubes of 10 bulbs, well over a pound of solid gold. I'd like them to start immediately, Jeb said, holding the cash out to Collis.
Usually we'd send them over first, but I don't see why not,
Collis said, taking the leather tubes and slipping them in his robes. Jeb turned back to the teachers. I need 2 cooks, 2 janitors, and a handyman. Find me the best you can.
Got it,
Mr. Everett said, his gaze already picking out specific individuals.
Thank you,
Mrs. Lang said, nodding, her eyes watering. Go, go, Jeb said, shooing them. What is it about teachers that makes it impossible not to put a Mrs. or a Mr. in front of their name? Even in my head. The reason Jeb had given them leave to pick out the rest of the employees was so that they could, one, pick out any family members they wanted to stay close to. Mrs. Lang picked up on that pretty quick. 2, pick people they were familiar with and could work well with. People the teachers would be familiar with were school lunch ladies, school janitors, etc. They existed in the same realm as the teachers themselves, and therefore know how to deal with children, even if it was in passing. Allowing a certain level of favoritism was good for an organization, and bringing their whole family together would keep them tight-knit. For this con, Jeb needed them to be tight-knit. Oddly enough, the handyman that Mrs. Lang picked out was mid-50s and had Lang for a last name. Weird. One of the cooks was a white-haired woman with an amiable grin. Last name Everett. Jeb overlooked it. They filled the remaining positions with people from their old schools, which was exactly what Jeb wanted. Each of the positions technically counted as unskilled labor, so all told, they ran him another 50 cool, leaving Jeb with just 50 left. That's a skeleton crew I'll need to take care of the kids I'm a kidnap. Honestly, it cost a whole lot less than I thought it would. He glanced at the last 5 tubes of gold when he felt a spark touch his mind, reminding him of the jet fuel lens resting back in his newly purchased mansion. Quick, before I go, are there any astrophysicists, roboticists, rocket scientists, or NASA people here? One hand went up near the back. Come on to the front. It was a skinny old man with a shock of unkempt white hair, his gaze somewhat manic, unlike Mr. Everett's. What's your name?
Eddie Davis.
And what do you do?
A little bit of everything, but robotics and AI are my specialty. I was in the middle of working on walking rover designs and programming its AI to deal with unexpected situations more efficiently when the tutorial happened.
At the mention of the tutorial, the old man's face contracted into an impressive scowl.
"You think you could fix a Roomba?" Jeb asked to lighten the mood. The older man stared at him.
"You're kidding, right?"
Collis leaned in.
"Excuse me, Mr. Trapper. I do not know what the roboticist, astrophysicist, rocket scientist, or NASA is. There hasn't been a specific request for any of those things in the entire time we've been selling humans." And I noticed only one man raised his hand.